Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It's a great pleasure to be here. It's actually my first Soil Science Society America meeting, which it's also been very, very great to participate in that. What I want to do today is take quite a big picture view of how plant evolution may have impacted on biogeochemistry. And to start with, I suppose if we think about the five soil forming factors, the role of the organisms in that, I guess what we haven't as a soil science community thought very deeply about is the extent to which the evolution of organisms has then changed soil processes over time. And so this presentation seeks to sort of start to ask some of those questions. As we think about the evolution of land plants, for example, from the very first land plants about 450 million years ago, these small liverwort-like plants, and then later developed onto things that were more sophisticated, eventually forming root systems and vascular systems, and then eventually reaching the types of plants that we find today. And those advances in plants automatically involved getting bigger, requiring more nutrients, being structurally more complicated, and also having the capacity to more quickly and effectively fix carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and convert that into organic compounds. And so one of the big questions that follows from that then is, to what extent has evolutionary advancement fed back into driving biogeochemical cycles? And in particular, what role has mycorrhiza and plant fungal symbiosis played in these processes? I guess one of the starting points is thinking about, well, why do plants form symbioses, or many plants form symbioses with fungal partners? Even the very earliest land plants, there's evidence both from the fossil record and subsequent experimental studies that show that the very earliest land plants were almost certainly co-associated with fungi. Most of them were, or many of them were. And this increase then in biomass reflects an increasing demand, and the key thing that is important in this is that the element which most typically limits plant growth in the long term in ecosystems is phosphate, which is derived primarily from the weathering of rocks and minerals. And so weathering processes, and particularly the splitting of calcium from phosphate, or the phosphorus from the calcium, represents perhaps one of the key processes by which ultimately plants can grow bigger biomass and ecosystems become larger and more productive. But in the process of causing that splitting of these elements, there are byproduct effects, both in terms of impacts on other calcium-bearing minerals, and the fates of those then going from the land into the oceans, ultimately those driving, for example, the burial of limestone and chalk, and then eventually that material being subducted and returned back onto the land and the CO2 back into the atmosphere, and of course starting off again giving us relatively rich igneous rocks containing phosphates, like calcium phosphate, which are then available to be weathered again in the system, so recycles. Over time, we know that the very earliest land plants, even before they formed roots, had formed symbiosis with fungal partners, and that this is a trait which has continued on to the present day. One of the other characteristics is when plants first evolved, the atmospheric CO2 concentrations were very, very high. And as plants became larger, particularly working through to tree-sized plants, the atmospheric CO2 fell, which is believed to be due to this increased weathering processes driving calcium export into the oceans and the formation of limestone and chalk, drawing down that CO2. When we look at this in terms of the evolution of mycorrhiza, though, the stages at which this happened were when plants had only mycorrhiza, which is like arbuscular mycorrhiza. There are two major types of this. There's a recently discovered form, which I'll talk a little bit about more recently, following on, with fungi in the endogonales, a mucoraceous group of fungi, as well as the more typical arbuscular mycorrhiza, which is associated with glomeromycotan fungi. Now, the reason why I want to emphasize this is that an awful lot of work on mineral weathering by plants and fungal symbionts has focused on much more recently evolved groups, the ectomycorrhizal fungi, which really only started to come into being important from, well, certainly no earlier than 100 million years. They may become more important from then onwards. So Processes related to ectomycorrhiza are, in terms of geological history, relatively recent. The processes that may have given rise to this enormous change in atmospheric CO2 and biogeochemical cycling changes must have been, if they were involving mycorrhiza, must have involved these more early forms of mycorrhiza, which incidentally are still present and prevalent today. So we've been doing some research. This is work with Katie Field, who's now at Leeds University, looking at these early plant fungal symbiont associations using the most primitive forms of land plants which are currently available for us to study. So these are using basal liverworts. The most basal group of liverworts, the Haplomitriopsida, only associate with these Mucormycotina fungi, and the increasing evidence is that this may have been the ancestral form of mycorrhiza. And then more recently evolved types of liverworts associate with the Glomeromycotina, and then some of the other more recently evolved groups of fungi in the even more recently evolved types of liverworts. They're an interesting group of plants to work in because they cover all these different types of fungal partnerships. What Katie Field showed in studies where she grew these liverworts in short turfs, where she could then insert mesh walled cores and she could trace fungal carbon moving from the from the plants into these cores, which excluded the rhizoids of the liverworts but allowed the hyphae in, and also looking at nutrient movement out from those cores. What she showed was the amount of carbon being allocated into the soil through these plants increased from the Mucormycotina associations to Glomeromycotina associations to some of these liverworts actually form associations with both fungi simultaneously. Seem to get a dual benefit from doing that. And that's also associated with a general pattern of increasing amounts of phosphorus in the plant tissue. So we see this reciprocal relationship. The plants supply the fungus with carbon and then they increase the amount of phosphorus that's available to them. It's worth pointing out that these studies don't involve weathering as such. And this work also was underpinned by some previous work that we'd done, which showed that at high CO2, the functioning of these symbioses tends to be more effective, so the conditions under which they evolved. Lower CO2, closer to present day values, the rates of growth are lower. But in all these cases, the black dots show you mycorrhizal plants compared to non-mycorrhizal liverworts, the same species in this case. And you can see the benefit of being mycorrhizal means bigger growth and also increased phosphorus uptake. And again, you can see different amounts of compost obviously increase the more nutrients that are available. So the key message here is that this symbiosis functions to benefit the plants in terms of increased phosphorus uptake. It functions best at high CO2, and the benefits to the plant are increased nutrient uptake. The fungus gains carbon from the symbiosis. Now, more recently, there was a paper that came out from Tim Lenton and others which made some very bold claims about early land plants radically changing the biogeochemistry of the earth based on extrapolations from experiments that they'd done with mosses. And we took a similar approach but used a system with these liverworts in which we buried, again, mesh bags containing basalt in this case and also some coupon samples of phyllosilicates mounted on glass slides. And in these studies, we could see and grew these plants at different CO2 concentrations. So just to explain these, the plant-free are our controls with no plant at all. And then we've got non-mycorrhizal plants and mycorrhizal plants. And then the green part shows you the amount of the nutrients within the tissues of the plants. And the other part of the bar shows you the amount that's been weathered out into the medium. So with calcium, you can see this big amplification of calcium weathering caused by mycorrhizal plants and plants in general. And again, you can see the same with the phosphorus, even stronger effect of the mycorrhiza here, amplifying the release of phosphate and calcium from the basalt mineral. What we could also see was on the silicate minerals, we could see clear evidence of fungal trenching structures where the fungi are actually dissolving out these silicates. So we could link these weathering processes directly to the fungal partners of the plants, and demonstrating that these arbuscular mycorrhizal glomerulian fungi are effective and would have been presumably in the past effective at causing these biogeochemical changes. What we also did was parallel experiments using trees in large mesocosms, and these tree studies demonstrated, bearing in mind this is the log scale, calcium weathering fluxes, that, as you might expect, the rates of weathering are much, much higher under trees than they are under liverworts, just because the plants are so much bigger. They root deeper into the soil, so the volume of soil interaction that they generate with their mycorrhiza is much greater. And that corresponds to the notion that, you know, as plants grew bigger, the impact of weathering increased, and this may have contributed to this overall drawdown of CO2 in the atmosphere through the Devonian period. So we've been trying to study this actually going back in time then, to say, well, what's the signature evidence of this if you go back and look at a fossil system? And we've had the great privilege of being able to work on a site in upstate New York where some paleobotanists have actually mapped the distribution of fossil trees across the floor of a quarry. And we then managed to seek permission, and we had permission granted, to drill rock cores through this forest site to actually link the soil to the individual trees. So this is a site which is 385 million years old. It's probably one of the oldest fossil forest sites in the world. And there are two different types of tree present. Cladoxyloxid type tree fern-like trees, and then the Archaeopteryx progymnosperm type of tree, which was the type of tree that's actually gone on to form trees more like the ones that we see today. It's a rather small, I'm afraid, but what this shows is the maximum rooting depth of these two different types in relation to the trunk diameters. And you can see with the Cladoxyloxids, they have very shallow roots, whereas with the Archaeopteryx trees, we see a very strong relationship. As the tree gets bigger, the roots get deeper, as you might expect. And Jenny Morris, who's been doing this work on this site, has undertaken very detailed logging work, tracing the roots and mapping the different pedogenic features that are present, and been able to recognise a whole series of features that are characteristic, including BT horizons with stickin sides, so translocated clays and clay enrichment, very highly structured soil horizons at the top. And the amazing thing is one of our cores even managed to go through a fossil fish, which is from the flood zone at the top of the system. It's just an amazing system to work in. Fancy getting a paleosol and a fish in your same sample. As we opened up the core, it was just like, wow, this is it. So there's over 20 rock cores that have been drilled. Some of these are 3 meters long. And looking at the iron redox effects and carbon Fe interactions, there are phenomenal root traces in here that are visible, and we managed to map the root distribution by depth for these different cores in relation to the different tree types present. And there isn't time to go into huge detail, but the key things I just want to show you, some of these different horizon features, you can see these lovely rhizotraces in the soil. But the key thing to show here is the differences in the soil horizon. So this horizon here, the second horizon, is relatively depleted in clay and has a very low clay content, whereas the next horizon, which has got this translocated, enriched soil horizon rich in clay, we see this big increase in the mixed layer illite smectite clays and also the reduction in the amount of silicates in this horizon. And it's interesting because I said to the group at the time, you know, the key sort of signature thing we were looking for as a forest soil was clear evidence of clay translocation and the accumulation of clays in this kind of way and the formation of these secondary clay minerals. And here we have a signature evidence of this is the forest soil 380 million years ago. Which is just amazing. So to be able to see that these are the processes that trees generate, along with their, almost certainly these would have been mycorrhizal as well, but we don't have any proof of that. And again, we've looked at the contrast between, on the right-hand side, the very smallest tree of the Archaeopteryx type, and the very largest tree on the left-hand side, near the trunk and then further out, because we were actually able to drill these along the fossil root systems. And again, there's evidence of this strong enrichment of the clays and potassium in that subsurface BTSS horizon, not so well developed where the tree's smaller. So there's clear evidence here of the link between the size of the tree and the intensity of the alteration of the minerals. So moving on from geological time back into the present day, one of the things we've been interested in is there evidence that more recently evolved tree types show enhanced weathering, and is that weathering linked to more recently evolved types of trees? So the more, are trees that are more recently evolved more effective at weathering than trees that diversified more longer ago? So comparing gymnosperms to angiosperms, and also comparing fungi, plants that have arbuscular mycorrhiza, AM, compared to those that have the more recently evolved ectomycorrhizal association. So this was field studies that were done at an arboretum in the UK, where we had a whole set of trees that were grown on the same soil type, same climate, same environment, and relatively large, well-established trees. We buried mesh bags under those trees, and then what you can see in the panel at the bottom left is the hyphal lengths within those mesh bags. So there's a couple of things that are important. Firstly, there's clear evidence that as you go from gymnosperms to angiosperms, the amount of hyphal lengths increase, and also as the evolutionary advance from arbuscular mycorrhiza to ectomycorrhiza also involves an intensification in terms of increased hyphal lengths of interaction. What you can also see is the strong selectivity of the hyphae preferring to grow into bags containing basalt compared to granite or quartz. So there's a high selectivity of the hyphae actually responding to the mineral grains within the bags. And this links back again to this notion that we've got carbon transfer from the plants going down to the fungi, and those that they're then cycling nutrients back. The pattern that we've seen for the basalt is also repeated. There's another study done at a different site with, again, a whole range of angiosperm and gymnosperm trees with arbuscular mycorrhiza and ectomycorrhiza, and again showing the effects on carbonate mineral weathering in the same sort of way. So final couple of things I want to talk about are these, looking at the role of atmospheric CO2 and different tree types on weathering and the feedbacks that are involved in that. And what we can see from these studies where we've grown plants in these big mesocosms, we can see that high CO2 conditions enhances weathering, and also that, again, we see this enhanced weathering with ectomycorrhiza over arbuscular mycorrhiza, and a pretty clear linear relationship between weathering rates and the amount of calcium silicate compared to the amount of carbon energy that's flowing into these mycorrhizal networks underground. And then final couple of points, that coupling between carbon energy flow and weathering rates can be exemplified by specific compounds in some cases. So for example, with Pactolus involutus, this ectomycorrhizal fungus, here we have clear evidence of the weathering rates being driven by oxalate production by the fungi. So the amount of calcium released from various minerals is strongly linked to the amount of oxalate that's being produced by the fungus. So this is mineral-specific oxalate production, so the amount produced depends on the mineral, and then the amount of calcium released ends up being bound into the oxalic acid forming calcium oxalate. And we've actually seen this, we've visualised this by systems where, firstly, this is apatite and quartz wells, and we've traced the carbon allocation into these, and you can see that where there's apatite, you get much more radioactive carbon going into the fungal networks. This is another experiment where we've added radioactive hydroxyapatite that we synthesized in the lab, and you can see the fungal hyphae growing down into this area of hydroxyapatite, and at the interface, there are a whole set of new crystals being formed, which is actually calcium oxalate crystals. So you can see this development of calcium oxide actually visualized in front of you. In this case, you can actually see that the radioisotope phosphorus that was started off as solid phase crystals has ended up being dissolved and taken up and transported on into the plant. And the final thing just to say is the links between these components in terms of photosynthate, climate, CO2 conditions, and the weathering rates ultimately suggests that there may be feedback mechanisms that operate so that as the CO2 in the atmosphere falls, the rates of weathering also decline in a non-linear way, so we get a strong feedback stopping over weathering rates as CO2 falls in the past through glacial periods. So I'm going to stop there and just leave the conclusions up, because I think everything's fairly should be fairly self-evident from that point, and then we'll not run out of time.
Concentrations. There was a note at the bottom about evidence for leaching.
Yes.
Remember that case? Can you talk about that a little bit?
The issue is that in the fossil forest study, there's a whole series of potential processes that are going on in terms of inputs from the flooding zone, and then also we were looking for evidence of leaching of elements coming out. And so that's done by looking at the relative abundance compared to the original parent materials in the system. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.